Blog Talk Radio.
Guten Tag, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Masonic Companion, and I'm your host for the next hour or so, Dale Graham. Thank you for joining me. I'm looking forward to another episode where I'm able to retrieve massive amounts of advice and wisdom from you. I hope you're all doing well this 12th day of January 2014. And let me do the calculations. It's the 12th day of the year. And if you can look up through that bank of clouds that's hanging over us where I am right now, we'll find that the moon is waxing gibbous, as all of the astronomers in the crowd would be keen to nod and be a bit bored. They already know that, isn't it? This is actually the... You can tell that I'm reading about Greek history. Things seem to be incomplete until I get around to these things. And you knew I'd get around to them eventually. It took 64 years to do this one. But you know, this is the month of Poseidon. Yeah. So it's in the Attica calendar. December, January was known as Poseidon. I'm not to cast aspersions on the Georgian calendar that we're working on, but you know, there's something about the Greeks. I don't know. Let me just share a few kernels with you. We're going to get into a little bit about the Baird, the Segi lecture coming up. You know about that. I'll give you a little reminder on that. In part, whatever information I have lying around here that I think may be of some use to stimulating discussion. And if you're joining and tuning in willingly to this, which I presume you are, then you're a Mason or a person that is tolerant of a bit of the production crew's technical difficulties with this show, but also more interested in the importance, and supportive of the importance of more in-depth discussion and thought around topics Masonic. I think it's becoming more and more important, and I've had some very, you know, if you start to probe things very deeply, you find that you can come out of your comfort zone. And this is certainly one of those. You're joining me around the topic of today, the heading under Freemasonry and a Sacred Trust. And this begins to become a challenge to reinforce the idea of our obligations and oaths being a challenge to a man. Help me here. We want to have we operationally sanitized Freemasonry from any kind of stress? Have we made it absolutely safe so that a man doesn't have to face an emotional challenge, an intellectual challenge, in order to step forward and receive the true mysteries of the order? Have we made it so safe that we've eroded meaning? And you know, we talked last week about the lunar, as we've evolved, we've sort of washed our hands of calculating meetings of a lodge that became an inconvenience because we heard that, you know, it was handy to have meetings around the period of full moon because of our rural setting and getting back and forth with the bright light of a moon to help guide us before streetlights and pavement in those days. However, I think that's only part of the explanation. I think it's fairer, and I think it's a fair question to put to you, and you give me your advice, of course. You tell me your opinion. And by the way, I hope you're drinking heavily before you give me that opinion so that it smacks of a bit of truth. That we've whittled away at the order so that it's become more and more a matter of convenience. And we hear that around us, I think, in a lot of the chatter that goes on, especially when we're wringing our hands, gnashing our teeth about membership and participation. Well, you know, there's also that attitude that if you don't appreciate what we have here, well, really, that's not our problem. It's not the problem of the order. But it is with an order that takes responsibility for each and every one of us. That's the issue, that sense of responsibility that may not be shared. It may not be going across from the order to the people that are coming in. Now, I think it's a little more complicated than to say, well, we're not guarding the gate. We're letting in the wrong people. Well, that's a slippery slope. It's an easy thing, and it's almost an indefensible statement to say, well, yeah, okay, we're letting in the wrong people. That's nothing to do with the individuals. That's about us. It's about the order, isn't it? And I'm not so sure. It's like, is there only a select kind of poor element of the population that is retrievable or is receptive to being reinvented? You know, that notion of making a better man, a good man better. Well, I've got over being glib and snide, and I've apologized to my elders for thinking that it's a bumper sticker, and surely to goodness, the essence of the Masonic Order is more than a slogan. I personally will never be able to accept that. But the idea that it instills is this sense of reinvention, that you're coming open-minded but ignorant, and you're looking for Masonic enlightenment, not general enlightenment of the going to have the epiphany that's going to unburden the world of all of the woes and complications that we face collectively. Do you think that I want you to think? I think that we've become a little lazy, that the dust has settled on us a little too often. And I don't think that has to do with our aging process. I think this is an intellectual. This is in our minds. Where's the challenge? Where's the challenge? We don't want anyone to be afraid. We don't want anybody, truly, we don't want anybody to be worried. We don't want anybody to feel any level of discomfort. And yet we're in an order where we're asking a great deal. We're asking people to make change. Well, you know, do you want me to smile out of this side of my face or the other side of my face? Do you want me to only change the things that are easy for me to change? Well, that's probably not going to have a lot of meaning to me in the long run, is it? I remember Socrates also said to us that a life unexamined is not worth living. And I guess I'm going to ask some of you to help me with, you know, I know we have to move beyond the Hellenistic philosophies. I know, because they were limiting. They were limiting. But when we go beyond that, you know, some of these statements are inescapable. If we don't take a serious look at what we're doing and what we mean, the meaning of what we're doing around ourselves, doesn't mean that we immediately fall into the sense that this throwing our hands in the air and claiming that we're victims of circumstance. Oh, this is elitist. Well, bullshit. That's like saying your life is elitist. Bullshit. I don't think any human being has the right to declare that, that they have, they're the elite, that that one down thinking that anything they don't like or anything that's complicated is over their head. Well, roll up your sleeves. Things that are, I don't know how to fit into the, this kind of thought, some of the statements of my Cyril Toombs, my grandfather, very wishful brother Toombs. You know, if it, anything that's worth doing is worth doing well. Well, if we're not going to put out a little effort, if it's not hard, it's not worth doing. You know, do the easy stuff. Well, you know, what are you going to gain from that? What kind of sacrifice, what kind of character development do you get from doing things simply that are easy? Well, that's a slippery slope too, isn't it? So when we turn to face the challenges, it's like, whoa, man, we're there alone. We face these challenges on an individual level, but they may be the conceit of mankind. They're not the conceit of one man's ego. If you don't examine yourself, and you're in the company of gentlemen who have and do and understand that, you're going to be they're going to be aware of you, and you'll have no clue. It's not that they're going to point it out and say, oh, their buddy over there hasn't examined himself. Nobody's going to do that. It's you, unexamined, are the lesson. We have to define what it means to examine ourselves. And the way we do that is by using the experiences and interactions of people around us. And that's important. So that's what this large, the unwashed democracy, that's what the citizenry of Freemasonry does for all the rest. You know, the ones that don't get it, that aren't examining, that are there to play and find that that's what they mean by have fun with it. Well, really? They do serve a useful purpose. Albeit, it would seem almost selfish, would it? But there you have it. Any validity in that? Maybe, maybe not. You know, our idea of the, we are burdened by, I think, we have some difficulty with this sense of being a democratic kind of an organization. Well, how do we fit the idea? Well, really not, are we? We're a meritocracy, at least in word, in name only. Do we move ahead by merit? Well, how do we measure it? It's measured by the collective. Mm-hmm. The collective has a sense of whether we're serving some purpose. It's not necessarily all that's valid, because you can get people that are very persuasive, that have no clue of what's going on, and they can actually convince me that, you know, I'd go along with them, even though I don't agree with anything they've said, but they're saying it in such a beautiful and eloquent way, particularly if they're able to influence a room full of people. Well, who am I to sort of contradict them? But then I can walk out the door and think, well, that was half-baked. And yeah, I'm not the only one in this conversation that does that. Excuse me. So where do we go after that? Ancient Greeks, eh? What did they teach us? They taught us a heck of a lot. They taught us and gave us skills that we needed and use today. They also taught us some of the traps. Are we a meritocracy in name only? Or is that just too far beyond our capacity, the capacity of a group of men that come together as we have to sort out merit? Merit probably changes as time goes by, or the perception of time moving occurs. what is important yesterday may not be important tomorrow. It's what's important right now. We want people with foresight, don't we? We want people that are visionary. But when people are visionary, that doesn't necessarily fit in with the need today. So we do things in the short run. We think in the short run. If it answers today's question, then that's a good thing. Is that merit? Well, somebody has to look at the urban landscape out there and say, well, you know, let me step out of this sort of utilitarian, industrial kind of mentality. Is there an aesthetic? Isn't there a beauty to the world around us? Being in a comfortable environment, doesn't that have an effect on us? The hell it doesn't. You and I walk around here, try and walk around, and find if you walk into a pub, the real deal. You know that we're not listening to 50 decibel power chords. There's an atmosphere, a chatter, a sense of the whole place that is comforting and stimulating and welcoming at the same time. We respond to the environments constantly. Could we live in a world where all the pubs were like that? I think, probably. Where we could sit down at a table with friends and have discussion at different times of the day that fits into our lifestyle. That, I think, is a good thing. Now, to create a different kind of environment, we have to be thinking on that level. Atmospheres are important to achieving our higher aspirations. If I commit this to you, that I truly am intent on having an entered apprentice around that I can influence and teach in whatever way I can, so that his abilities go far, far beyond my own. That, to me, would be the essence of Freemasonry. Not solely, but it's really important. It's like a contribution. Now, how do I know that? Merit in the moment is one thing. Merit in the long run is another. We're probably going to see more pushback when we're listening to visionaries talk about the bigger picture. Because immediately that takes all of us into an area where it creates great anxiety. There's a difference between people that are visionary and people that are guessing. Or have you never thought about it? Or can't you tell the difference? Like we just had recently with the Higgs boson, Professor Higgs. The Higgs boson, what do we hear? A man that for 30 years sat with a theory that was considered conjecture until we developed the technical expertise, this something out of the, you know, science fiction, out of a Heinlein book, or Arthur C. Clarke. A great mind could conceive of the Large Hadron Collider, and then created the technology that gave a proof, a fact, validated the theory. And here's this professor thinking that if this wasn't true, then everything that he knows is invalid. And what do we find? Facts fit. Is that man a visionary? Is that man the scientist? Or is that man guessing? I think weak-minded amongst us assume that anything speculative, anything that has to do, that isn't fact-based, isn't concrete, is a guess. Well, right. Calculated guess is one thing. Nonsense and doing that as a theme is another. Doing that as a theme, saying everything that is visionary is guesswork, fits into the difficulty, the trap that I experience with the Hellenistic philosophies. And I'm thinking about the Stoic, the Skeptic, and the Epicurean, right? So the skeptic is going to say to us, well, you know, the information that you're giving me seems valid, but there's a lot of other information out there that contradicts it, and it seems valid too, so I'm not really sure what side of that coin or fence that I sit on. Well, really, there's a caveat to that sense of control. Needing to have control doesn't mean that we're necessarily doing things right. How do we know? We hope that the consensus that we develop are shared by people that are convincing, are able to, that have within their own bearing, their own function, a sense of commitment, of diligence, of forthrightness. Those are the qualities of a man that can be, that can validate for us whether something is complete conjecture or it does have some validity. And then we may be talking to small-minded men who have no sense that you can extrapolate from the poet's work significant ideas. Am I interested in that kind of person? Not really. No, not really. I'm more interested in the minds of you know, people that are making statements, making large, large statements, and thinking it very, very broadly. Yeah, that's important to me. That is. I don't know why. Here's one. And step out of what we know about the man and say gravitation is not responsible for people falling in love. Mm-hmm. I want to know God's thoughts. The rest are details. The hardest thing in the world to understand is the income tax. Or reality is merely an illusion, albeit a very persistent one. These are from Albert Einstein. You turn your back on this type of thing at our peril. In order to form an immaculate member of a flock of sheep, one must, above all, be a sheep. Yeah, I think that's me. I like to think that. But remember, as he says, the important thing is not to stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existing. So you keep doubting and asking these questions. Huh? Yeah. Anyway, I talk about sacred trust. Do you feel that way? Do you feel that what you've been given is a shared responsibility for a sacred trust? Ancient landmarks have been preserved for centuries. The ethics of our earliest civilizations reveal a provenance that tells us progress does not extinguish need of awareness. You know, we're 21st century men. The Greeks, you know, what, 5th century BC, 4th century BC, noted for us this need for increased awareness, this exploration of the conscious being. They were exceptional in the fact that they were apparently the first, and they gave us records. And we note them as one of the great cultures of the history of mankind. And you need to hear my declaration of, I don't know, is it a conflict of interest, the great cultures, Greece and Rome. And after that, I just can't tell. Certainly with what I'm living in today, hell no. But there I'm being a bit too glib, eh? These great cultures were not without their limits. Time sanitizes and washes everything, makes it all look clearer. 100 years from now, you're going to be known for your spectacular personality, your charm, your great wit, and your successful application of these wonderful ideas in everything that you touch and do. The sun is going to shine out of every orifice that you have. In 1,000 years, How are you going to be remembered? Well, you're going to be remembered for what you've contributed long term. Is what you're selling or what you're producing, is the merit of what you're doing going to resonate from you for 1,000 years? Nice way to think about effort and your contribution. Me? I don't know. I tend to be enjoying my own company more than, you know, being around and in situations where I'm being exposed to things that are very, very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. I'd rather be alone. It's like learning. You learn something and all of a sudden you can't get it. It's like that tune. You hear it and it's tuneful, but you can't really get it out of your thought. It's persistent. Ancient landmarks have been preserved. But even hundreds of years later, we still have this need. Progress does not extinguish the need. That's a shared task, a shared learning requirement of all of man. An understanding of philosophies influences the judgment of some people, but not the entire community. This lack of permanence suggests strongly that an ethical life requires construction by an individual. You construct the ethical life, and I construct the ethical life, and John, and Richard, and Mike, and Gareth, everybody that comes at this constructs the ethical life. And together, do we have a community of ethics, ethical people? Yeah. Yeah. So that's how it occurs. And this requirement to construct that requires an examination of self, of who we are. And remember, it wasn't that long ago when this was considered, you know, this wasn't really being considered in terms of the phenomena. And we've gone over this at different times about the life of Montaigne, didn't we? Yeah. When even then, for a person to write their own thoughts and to write their own feelings was a first. What's a first, eh? How to get on well with people, how to deal with violence, how to adjust to losing somebody you love. Well, these are the questions that just the Renaissance writers were obsessed about this. And yeah, I brought up the French writer, what's his name, de Montaigne. What was he, about 1533 to 1592. Perhaps the first truly modern individual. And he wrote the essays, but, you know, he was honest. And in a way that people can still appreciate. And it's hundreds of years later. And what he did was he explained something that was a universal, how to live. As you and I do, how to improve. Yeah. And really what we're all saying, all of that, the philosophies of the Greeks, the function and progress of the Romans, even the economic experiment that we call capitalism, it was an effort to live a good life. Well, given time, we see that these beautiful garments wear out on the stress points. You know, you see that threadbare elbow. And the knees wear out of our favorite pants and our heels of our socks sort of disappear. And the same with these social experiments. We try it and then we examine, take a close look and say, that's not working. Now we have the problem of the redistribution of wealth. We don't know what the hell to do with it, but we do know how to produce it. And yeah, has this eradicated the despots and some of them, you know, terrible people? Well, we don't have, do we have Vlad the Impaler running around anymore? Probably not. At least I want to think not. But we still have nitwits that will do, you know, bloody, they'll be able to justify idiotic things like waterboarding and saying, well, you know, that's not really torture. That's like, that's an introduction to reveal everything that you know. It's not really torture. Really? So what question do you ask that gives the information you need? The universe does not owe an explanation of existence. Not to you, not to me. Nope. Our purpose is to procreate. You know, the purpose of mankind. Not to screw things up. Well, we're here doing what we do. So we built these little machines, and they produce gases, and that affects the, you know, it's absorbed into the atmosphere. It's like if we keep throwing pee into the ocean, it's eventually going to be unfit for to drink. Well, we've used it just to dilute some pretty nasty things. Back in when I was, you know, it wasn't that long ago, a lot of you were boys, they were blowing things up in the oceans. Well, where do you think all that atomic crap, all that radiation has settled? In the air. All these so-called new man-made phenomena up in the atmosphere that you're breathing. Cancers, oh my, completely disconnected. Yeah, well, yes, of course. Things get out of hand, you know. Things, shit happens. Nobody owes us an explanation for that. We have to figure it out. You keep doing that, probably not what we consider a good life. You know, our purpose is to procreate, to extend the species so that the species continues. You ain't going to happen. An answer beyond that depends on what truths we care to employ. Each one of us in that construction of that, what do you want to use all the metaphors of your Freemasonry? Go right ahead if you need the lodge to find. Let's do that. We're not going to pump ourselves up onto a pedestal of, you know, a holy temple and all that stuff. Let's not do that to ourselves just yet. It increases expectations, and we're probably likely to screw up if if the expectations get too great. Let's keep humble. That's a 12-year-old, and it's done quite well. So credit to its parents, that one. Our purpose. So it depends on what truths you care to apply. So that's you. That's not me. I can't say, well, these are the things that you should follow. I would never do that. That would be arrogant. This is for us to discover, including the realistic sense evidence may be confusing. Yeah, the fact may be confusing. Or fools can use it to manipulate. They can be very, very persuasive. And if they're better orators than you or I, and they're speaking out their mind, well, they're going to influence a lot of people, aren't they? Yep. We're going to create weapons of mass destruction out of what? I'll pull that one back. That's just too much. Yet Freemasonry continues to offer half the world. I'm thinking men. Sorry, less than half the world, 49% of us. Well-thought-out options for creating a better life. I'm not exactly sure about that claim. I'm not exactly sure that Freemasonry is exclusionary. The way we practice it is through a fraternal order. It's not to say the principles and the ancient landmarks are not applicable to women. Bang, God bless them. Or to, you know, those are the only two, or any other configurations. It's just that we've agreed to practice this through fraternal connections and then to explore the boundaries, the functions, the benefits of fraternalism. But Freemasonry in and of itself doesn't say, thou shalt not. No, no. It gives us, the way we know it constitutionally, it gives us, if we probe a little bit behind the Constitution to the principles, you know, the betterment of mankind, to think about somebody else before you act. That's a good world. Generation to generation, this becomes the sacred trust of Freemasonry, at least to my mind, to investigate the metaphysics of existence. The metaphysics, the intangibles, things that aren't there, but you know they're there. I can't see that you like me, but I know it. I know it from your expression, from the words that you choose, from reactions. But do I see likeness? Do I see fraternity? I don't see that. It's an idea. The genesis of Freemasonry was ideas that grew from small groups of men, discussing the larger issues. Freemasonry is not a discussion of 40,000, 50,000, 3.5 million, 4 million. It's between men. It's over a cup of coffee. It's in the cafe, coffee houses in London. It's over a beer. It's over a sense of conviviality. And Jesus, the temperance movement can, you know, if you have to hang up now, go ahead. If you have to go on to do other things, I think I'm talking a little bit beyond that. I'm talking about whatever it takes for people to feel comfortable. And when you feel comfortable, I hope, is when you can begin to overcome apprehensions and begin to trust one another so that there can be a fluid, interesting, and engaging dialogue and discussion of the bigger ideas. What's important, what's not? What's embarrassing, what's not? What's necessary, what's limiting? Well, you don't do that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week without being a little bit of a nutter. You do it periodically. When the moment is right. Well, the moment necessarily, I wish in my heart that I could come up with these moments because somebody said, well, 7:30 on Tuesday night is one of those moments. Yeah. I need a little bit more. Freemasonry grows organically because of the constant ability to adjust to environmental changes. I wonder who said that. Shit, I said that. It grows organically. We have this constant ability. We can say, well, there's constant pressure and we never change. It is as diverse as need be to fulfill the needs of the functions, the needs of what we're dealing with today. That's how diverse our ability is. There's no need today. We're going to go about our business. Thank you very much. Relax, put your feet up. Read the paper, call a few friends, period. The primary number in the or want to know the secrets? I'll give you a little secret here. And this is from the part of my life that is entitled, What the Hell Does He Know? He Doesn't Know Shit. The primary number in our order is one. One, mustard seed. As long as one Freemason exists, as long as he knows the history of ideas required by speculative Freemasonry, then Freemasonry continues. All elements of Freemasonry are included for a reason, whether we see it or not. The theorist, Talcott Parsons, helped us understand that. Structural functionalism, I think he called it. What we have around us would not exist without every element doing its bit. It's like a human being. We're so silly to say, oh, this is the most important part. Really? Well, you need the whole package. You need all the organs functioning, don't you? And then you start to get into definitions of what a person is. Am I a sack of chemicals held together with this great big organ we call skin? Well, the question to ask ourselves, all elements are included for a reason. Yeah, you decide that. There's purpose. We haven't got a clue what that reason is, but there's purpose behind it. If you ask yourself, challenge yourself that way, you'll find it. If you don't ask the question, you're never likely to see it. What elements of the past are important? Are we so eager to discard what we don't understand? And then I conclude this with the notion of traditional observance. What elements of the past? Well, I can't tell you that I understand all of the past of the Masonic order. But I can tell you I'm better off when I sit down with you and you bring your understanding of the order to the discussion. Yeah, that's important. That's mightily important. The importance of learning and being receptive, that's not something that's unique to Freemasonry either. That's our nature. We are curious, contemplative creatures. We are curious because if we see something that we don't quite understand, we'll go over and look around. What's beyond that corner? Well, there's be the hesitant masses and the sheep over there that will say, oh, we're perfectly satisfied here. There's always going to be one curious George amongst us that will say, but right, let's go and see what the hell's over. Yeah, all right. And then we look around the corner and we find more people like us looking around the corner back at us saying, where'd you guys come from? What are you thinking? What are you up to over there? We're curious. That doesn't stop. That doesn't stop. When we find something, we try and understand the properties, and then we try and understand how it applies to us or if it does. Do we just toss it? More and more, we're learning not to do that. And we've created this entire wizardry of computers that allows us to test more hypotheses than is possible within one mind at one time. It's like we're accelerating the exploration of fact. And then we're hit with this, we still process one bits of information with this enormous computer that sits inside of our skulls. But it doesn't make sense when it's just a wave of data coming to us all at the same time. Well, data never makes sense. It's when we make the connections between data that it becomes information. And then it's what that information reveals and whether we need it. Information and data out of context, it's like one of those, that's nice, Dale. That's very nice. That's a very clever buy. Yeah. Doesn't shit. Who cares? That's the point. It's when it has meaning. So what parts of the order and what parts of the history are worth bringing forward? That, I think, is the sacred trust. No, I don't think it's puffery, and I don't think it's ritual. No. I think it has to do with preserving things that are just really, really useful. Well, we can't do that. Let's say that I know 0.1% of what there is to preserve from our past. Let's say that for argument's sake. But in my heart, I trust that there's that you have the other 99.9% that is needed. Well, we need to be able to talk. We need that chatter to be able to figure it out. And can we do it? I think keeping it small is probably safer. Remember, do you remember you've heard about the trial of Socrates? He was charged with misleading young men of Athens, right? And he was charged with the unrest of trying to create a reason to challenge the notion of Athenian gods. Well, in every single day in the life of an Athenian, there was devotions to a variety of gods. And these were gods that were, had elements of humanness about them. The one that I'm studying right now is, I think it said Pietros. And this is the goddess of persuasion. Well, we know that persuasion is important. We know that it's an element of our character and our being that we need to be able to understand. So they actually had it as a deity. And they had, in Athens, there were centers, agros, where people would give offerings. So we could give flowers or a dove or a sacrifice a goat. But we also had little tiny shrines if we were in Athens. And we could make our observance that way. So even the poorest people would make multiple observances in a day. If you were poor and you couldn't cover all of them, you might make four or five religious observances every day. This was really important to Athens. So what did Socrates, what was he claimed to have said? Well, he was claimed to have challenged and got and taught young men to think for themselves. Curious that you tell me, am I stretching this out too far? Am I going back too far in history? That it was three men who brought about the death of Socrates. Where have I heard that theme before? You know, and were they worthy and deserving to be able to challenge one of the great minds? He was 70 years old when he was brought to trial. And he wasn't, and this was a guy that had been a real pain in the ass in Athens for generations. Really. He was known for, if people were walking past in the street, he was known for walking up and asking them very essential questions, just out of the blue. They didn't know him. He was scruffy and he wasn't in good shape. When he was younger, he had fought in the defense of Athens, yeah. But he wasn't a whole lot of eye candy. And he would come up to you and ask, what is love? What is the meaning? What is life? And he was expecting an answer, a discussion. And during the course of his life, we know that he would have his arse kicked, as they say in the Everglades. People would push him and shove him and ridicule him and beat him up because he was being so unusual. And yet it took three people to accuse him. One was a performer, an orator. And another was, what do you call it? Tanners. Yeah, and the other was sort of a gadfly, didn't really have a lot of substance under his fingernails, you know? And so there was three of them that brought the issue forward. And this was considered, you know, great, you know, how is the great philosopher? He was known. Yeah, whether he was jumping, he was sort of jumping out of the shadows and asking these essential questions or not. It was known. The jury was selected. Well, in Athens, every single person was considered a Democrat. Everybody was considered a politician. So, to be selected for the committee, you showed up. And the first 500 eligible people, of course it was men, were selected for his jury. Oh, did you not know it was 500? You were thinking that it was 12, were you? A small group of people that could discuss the facts? yeah. Nope. And these three brought together the charge and said it was so serious that the penalty would be death. So there was a huge, this was really popular in the day. The whole city was alive with the knowledge of this trial. And the 500 presumed to hear the charges against. Now, in Athens at the time, this was really, you know, if everybody's salivating about the decisions of our courts not being satisfying, and we want to take the law in our own hands, well, the Greeks did. If a prosecutor won the case, it was known that immediately he could physically assault the defendant. If he won the case and beat the hell out of him in front of everybody. Beat the hell right out of him. He won the case. So that's, you know, where the hell do you go with that? That was what we consider by today's standards enormously primitive. But at that day, that was considered justice. But he was condemned for conducting this dialogue. He had these young men. He was known to hang around the gymnasium. Yeah. He was known for that. But this was a guy whose entire force of life was to develop a better society for the good of, to function for the good of mankind, to offer a contribution. Well, that belief, that pattern, that force wasn't in effect in the day. Not when he was being tried. No. So we know what the outcome was, huh? The 500. And these weren't the elite. Come on. These weren't the elite of society. No, 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 no. These weren't. The Athenians had been through battles. The Persians, they had to kick the ass off the Persians. Xerxes came in and he was brought his big a navy, and he brought his troops and overwhelmed Athens and then burned the shrines, burned the city. And we know that the best and brightest went and fought. Everybody fought and did their share. After that, what are we left with? Well, we're left with people that had flaws and weaknesses, let's say, okay? So Miletus was a poet, and he initiated the prosecution. Then he was, but the argument is he was a bit of a puppet, you know. And then there was a fellow by the name of Anytus, and he was brought forward as one of the accusers. So you know, these guys, Socrates had a relationship with the son of Anytus, and he said, I had a brief association with the son of Anytus, and I found him not lacking in spirit. It is not known how far the relationship went, but it seems that may have been the source of a problem, you know. Was it a jealousy? But Anytus disapproved of his son's relationship. Of course he did. And the third accuser was a guy named Lycon, and he was known as an orator, another profession Socrates held in low regard. These are the three guys that brought the charges against Socrates. And he was expected to show up and defend himself. Well, it wasn't like, it was so large, the congregation was so large, the court, that it was impossible for Socrates to hear everything that was being said about him. And when somebody was yelling, it's entirely convenient for the audience to be whipped into, the 500 of the jurors, to be whipped into a frenzy. And so it was a very raucous, almost out of control, loud event. And in that, this single old philosopher had to defend himself. When I heard about this, it made me begin to think about whether there were parallels and whether some of the Hieronymic legend was a reflection of the work and the events of Greek culture. And in fact, about the life of Socrates. I'll come back to you with that. This, it was uncanny because discovered in the readings the first mention of the importance of the northeast corner. Never knew. And it's a reference point for measurement of the province. So I'll talk to you a bit about that later. Anyway, you got it? Am I making sense here for you? All right. I'll go away now. Three. We do need to be able to move on here, for good God's sakes. Let's see. We've got Robbie Burns night coming up. You ready for that? Get your finest, get your suit pressed and your hair cut. That's coming up on January 25th, isn't it?
Yeah.
He was born on the 25th, so that's the day. You know, the celebration may be on the weekends and things like that, but that's the day when he was born. And he was born in Alloway, Scotland, in 1759. And he died in Dumfries on the 21st of July, 1796. Dumfries, I think that's Wolf Hoffman's stopping ground when he was a young man, Brother Hoffman. And he was a poet, but he was writing about, you know, in the vernacular, how the locals spoke. And he wrote poems about what was going on in the time, not so much the romantic aspirations of people or the noble aspirations, but what was really going on, the politics and civil issues. Most of us have just finished our annual rendition of Auld Lang Syne. Robert Burns, though, acquaintances held the first Burns Supper on the 21st of July, the anniversary of his death. There you go. That was the first Robbie Burns Supper. And that was held in Ayrshire, Scotland, in the late 1700s. And the date was later changed to January 25th, his birthday. Burns Suppers are now held by people and organizations with Scottish origins worldwide, including particularly in Australia, Canada, England, and the United States. And I guess if you're saying Scottish origins and you consider that everything Scottish was Celt at one point, and you turn your way and look to Ireland, we're in good company. So we have get your kit together and remember the guy. It's coming up. Man's inhumanity to man makes countless thousands mourn. This is one of his quotes. Prudent, cautious self-control is wisdom's root. That's a pain in the rear end to try and pull that one off. So much easier just to fly off the handle, walking around with little fits of temper and being out of control, being anxious and covering up with our tempers, blah, blah, blah. Suspense, he says, is worse than disappointment. Suspense is worse than disappointment. Could be. The wide world is all before us, but a world without a friend. There is no such uncertainty as a sure thing, says Burns. He's a thoughtful man. Thoughtful. The snowdrop and primrose our woodlands adorn, and violets bathe in the wet of the morn. Simple. I liken them to our old world squad. I must needs say comparisons are odd. I won't tie us up with that. Coming up soon, you should be thinking about getting tickets for the Sankey lecture, Charles Sankey. This is exceptional coming up, and it's the 30th of March. Well worth the drive to Niagara. Better to have some good company like the likes of you fellas. We've had a pretty interesting series of lecturers, haven't we? In 2010, we had a lecture, the very first, we had a stand-in. This is actually a stand-in for Malcolm Davies. Professor Davies was teaching at the time, and he agreed to come to St. Catharines, fly over from, where was he at the time? I think he was in the Netherlands. A little piece of trivia you may not be aware. And he was brave enough, and he thought, right, this has never been done before, and it makes a it gets the things planted, takes things to a more scholastic level in Canada. Let's do it. And the man died. And, of course, we should all feel good about this. His very, very good friend, Andreas Onoforce, Dr. Andreas Onoforce, Brother Andreas Onoforce. He's the director of the Center for Research into Freemasonry at the University of Sheffield. And without hesitation, when he heard what had happened, he stepped forward to do the lecture. Andreas, a lovely, lovely man, and very, very, I think, keenly invested as a Freemason. And he was invested in the, initiated in the, in Sweden. And we've had really interesting conversations over drinks talking about how what is expected of a Freemason in Sweden. Magnificent. Magnificent. Obviously at a much different level than what it is, the way it's practiced here in Ontario. But just amazing and, you know, really interesting to listen to. He was raised in Germany in a Swedish-German family, and after a period of travel and studies, he served in the Swedish Army between 1993 and 96, and interrupted by studies in the history of sciences and ideas. In 1997, he took up his undergrad studies at the history of sciences and ideas at the University of Lund in Sweden, and he did his... he was admitted to a German PhD scheme at the University of Greifswald. Not bad for the fellow. Since then, he's undertaken postdoctoral research in Swedish 18th century Freemasonry. And he taught courses mainly within European studies. And he's had a large interest in press history and the history of sciences. And he's published over 40 papers. Very, very. So he did his first talk on perceptions of Freemasonry from the 18th century to the Internet. I won't even begin to tell you. I know that a lot of you are already there. This is just remarkable. This is just remarkable. And what was different about it was he is so powerful and packs so much information in, you do need to be in the audience and study very carefully. So I will tell you that it went over exceptionally well. Just the talk, but it was startling. It was like, I think generally the feeling was, what the world did we just experience? We know it was powerful. We know it was serious-minded. But for the likes of me, I had never witnessed anything quite like that before with this consummate academic. So that was the very first. And could we have set up anything any better than that? Well, you know, setting things up is easier than completing them. So, of course, the work to be done required was picked up by Jessica Harlam Jacobs from the University of Florida, Department of History. She spoke to us on her material from her book, Builders of Empire, Freemasonry and British Imperialism from 1717 to 1927. And she was, of course, who knew at the time that she came to us as the top professor from the University of Florida. Well, how many hundreds of thousands of students are there? Go Gators, as she told us. And she was one of the voted by the students as the best lecturer. And she delivered. When she stood up in the audience, everything that she did got better and better and better. You know, more and more in depth. It was exceptional. The quality of her work was beyond doubt, more than we could have ever imagined. And we learned, and by the way, we do learn. Stephen Bullock came to speak to us on the heart of Freemasonry in upstate New York. And he had been written a very, very interesting book called Revolutionary Brotherhood, Freemasonry and the Transformation of the American Social Order, 1730 to 1840. And But he had done that. We knew that. But Steve was just a really, really interesting guy. So he was making connections about the William Morgan affair. And very, very powerful speaker. And we had great fun with him. He was once again exceptional. That was 2012. Last year, who did we have? But we had Dr. Joy Porter. She's professor of Indigenous history at Hull University, and she was a senior lecturer and associate dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Swansea, and she was just very, very powerful. Very powerful, and daunting. It was daunting listening to her. The audience was was just exceptional, and the response was exceptional. The work was Native American Freemasonry was startling, and we can do this. We should be able to have that level of speaker over and over again, you would say. Well, we have. 2014, we have the Renee Rafferty, Professor Rafferty, is speaking to us this year, and she is the person that very briefly captured the audience when she introduced the keynote speaker, Steve Bullock. And she amazing the way that she had this infectious connection with the entire audience. Completely, I think, can we say completely surprised everybody or anybody? Except those who knew, the people in the department that knew of her work, were completely pleased. They knew. They had that sort of that sense like, watch what's going to happen here. This is a good thing, and lo and behold, did it ever? She delivered on the goods. So this would be Renee Lafferty Salini, excuse me, associate professor, and she's going to be speaking on Brothers in Arms, Freemasonry, and the War in 1812. We've just come out of celebrations, acknowledgments, and commemoratives of the War of 1812, and Sir Isaac Brock's work, and of course the entire Niagara area is rich in that experience. So if you are looking for an opportunity to accelerate your Masonic knowledge and to have a great opportunity to learn, Dr. Charles A. Sankey lecture coming up on the Sunday, the 30th of March, is close at hand. And I would encourage any and all of you out there to make the effort. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. Remember, he who joyfully marches to music rank and file has already earned my contempt. He has been given a large brain by mistake, since for him the spinal cord would surely suffice. Ah! Einstein, where are you going with this? The disgrace to civilization should be done away with at once. Hera wasn't at command. How violently I hate this. How despicable and ignoble war is. I would rather be torn to shreds than to be a part of so base an action. It is my conviction that killing another under the cloak of war is nothing but an act of murder. Now, Al, don't hold back. Why don't you tell me what you really think? He doesn't say whether this isn't a man that's talking about motivation or the why of it. He's talking about the what of it. So unfortunate, isn't it? That's a little bit breathtaking, but everything about the guy was. Everything. We need a little bit of something to break that tension. We want to get back into the mood that I've tried to set with the music at the onset. little, I always thought a little bit of King Oliver, you know, that's from 1924. He was, that was when Louis Armstrong, back then, jazz was still a group, it was a band, and he began to change it into a solo art. You know, we listened to those beautiful riffs, and when you listen to it, to the opening, listen to the trumpet portions of it. That was the very first time we began to hear that. You know, the very first time it was heard. And West End Blues was taped in 1928, and that shows how jazz was changing. Clarinet was more, you know, in the background. It's beautiful. And they had Earl Hines at the piano, and we hear, you know, that sort of swing. So it's you'll hear that piece over and over again. That's called West End Blues, by the way. So, and that was when jazz was beginning to change, and we have Louis Armstrong to thank for, he's passed away, of course, but a lot going on. Do you want to know things? Do you want to know about things? I'm going to tell you about things here. Bentley Hughes and the Hemlock Cup, we'll get into that in another time. How about, are you interested in a little bit about mysteries? Can we handle anything that has anything to do with making our brains work today? I want to recommend, if you're inclined, you want to add some interesting books that you borrow, go and buy or borrow a copy of Whence Come We. We hear this referred to constantly. It's almost like a little sideline constantly. But this is a book published by the authority of the Grand Master in 1980 in Hemel. So, and it has a small foreword. Interesting, in November of 1975, the Grand Master, Most Worshipful Brother Eric Nanceval, named a special committee charging it with the responsibility of preparing a publication to mark the 125th anniversary of Grand Lodge. The committee was composed of Most Worshipful Brother William Bailey, Right Worshipful Brother David Bradley, later to become Most Worshipful, and Aubrey M. Ramey, and C.E.B. LeGraisley, and Brother Brian B. Thurston. The last name subsequently found it necessary to withdraw in response to the pressing emergencies of his public and private avocations. Okay. David C. Bradley, who went on to be the person that brought about the College of Freemasonry. So some really, really interesting contributors, a long list, and they're all given. Charles Sankey was on that committee, yes, and Nanceval, the Grand Master. You know, these were people that hit the long ball here, you know. No shortage of talent in that crew. You can imagine the discussions too. Knowledgeable Freemasons like that, at that level. The subtitle of the book is Freemasonry in Ontario, 1764 to 1980. And so they even considered it a trifle, as they say, misleading. The true history of Freemasonry would have to discuss each lodge in each district, as well as recounting the progress of the central administration. So we see that this was a group thing that separated out those issues. The administration was separate and apart from the development of Freemasonry in the lodge and district. For the early period, it dealt with constituent lodges, but thereafter the emphasis shifts to the provincial grand lodges and to the Grand Lodge. Remember, this is talking about a piece of the pieces of Freemasonry that didn't exist today. What exists today didn't exist when this was starting. So we have the origin of modern Masonry to the earliest Masons in America, and a considerable amount of detail. This is a wonderfully laid out reference material, and you can't help. It's a very small small book. It's only, what are we looking at here, 278 pages. I can't help but find it useful. It talks about the startups of things, but if you do get a borrow a copy, you find this in your library, and if you don't have it in your lodge library, knock on the door of a lodge not too far away, and you'll find a copy. These things are lying around in used bookstores as well if you want to repatriate yours the way I did copies. And you'll find that some of the old me, since if they know that you have an appetite for this type of thing, will be very happy to make sure that their library and their material heads on to your library and will be put to good use. So it's pretty wonderful and amazing that way. So dozens of Freemasons must have lived in pioneer America, but their very names are lost to us. Sometimes they banded into lodges, not by any warrant of constitution, but simply by immemorial right. They got together. The Grand Lodges had not yet established their authority, and Masons still had this as an ancient prerogative. So that's this is talking about the day before it was the day. So we have these were lodges that met according to the old customs at the Black Horse. I'll talk to you about one that met at the Black Horse Tavern in New York in 1731. You know, before us. So these are early days, and getting back to early 17th and 18th century. And there is a fascination or a keen interest in passing this on. Don't think of it as repetition. Think and remember that there's an orientation of the new boy, the new apprentice that comes through the door, doesn't know the things that we have talked about for 20 years. And over that time, we have a constant process of renewal. Some of us are passing on, and some of us are coming through the door. And so when the fellows are coming through the door, we need to convey the information that's important, useful, benchmarks, pivotal defining points in the history of Freemasonry. Like we've talked here about the ancients and moderns not so long ago. And we know that from the earliest days, the older grand lodges, the moderns, had encouraged the upper classes to join. Not a bad idea. And invariably, the grand master was either a peer of the realm or a prince of the royal blood, of course. The ancients appealed more to the working classes and tradesmen, and may have had more of a sense of the Irish Grand Lodge. And the moderns are made up largely of government officials or leaders of the business world. And you had sort of the establishment, and then you had the people. Members of the early ancients lodge were described as very poor mechanics, though honest men. This is back in the days how they were described. And when the revolution broke out, the moderns naturally tended to side with the British, while the ancients more often joined the revolutionaries. Yeah, okay. The provincial grandmasters for the moderns in Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania, and South Carolina were all loyalists. And two of them left the colonies. In New York, the lodges of the moderns were left rudderless, and those that survived were taken over by the provincial grand lodge of the ancients. In Pennsylvania, the moderns vanished altogether, leaving the way clear for the ancients. And we want to look particularly at three provincial grand lodges which played a role in planting Freemasonry in Canada. And that was Massachusetts, moderns, New York, moderns, and New York, ancients. So it was a blend of the influences and activities of these different lodges and different forms of lodges that contributed to what we have. The first meeting of the Ancients Lodge in Quebec was 1785, when part of the 4th Battalion of Royal Artillery was stationed there. It had a lodge attached to it, number 213, and that lodge purchased warrant number 9 in 1787. It became a civilian lodge in 1829 and is still working as Albion Lodge number 2, the GRQ. That's a nice little piece of history. Early Masonry in Upper Canada, before the first provincial Grand Lodge in the colony of New France became British, by the Treaty of Paris of 10 February 1763, Ontario didn't have probably didn't have enough to fill Maple Leaf Gardens. Enough people. There were a few French traders and a couple of forts and some more or less, you know, they hadn't really been kept up. They'd been built, but moved on. There wasn't a lot of conflict around Kingston, Toronto, and the American side of the Niagara and stuff like that. The story of our pioneer lodges is difficult because the records are just, you know, The first Masonic lodges in the province of Ontario west of the Ottawa River were located at Detroit. Now, of course, the city is in the United States, but it remained British long after the American Revolution, up until 1796, and it was regularly known as Detroit, Canada. There were several military lodges there. Maybe that's what's wrong with it. You know, it's just been the first major American city to go declare bankruptcy. Maybe what they're saying is they need Canada to take them back. Certainly, you know, I think that's worth looking at. We could reconnect with Detroit. So we had a number of lodges started. Funny to think of that. That was west of the Ottawa River. The first was in Detroit, huh? Just amazing. In 1791, by the Constitutional Act, the colony of Quebec was divided into the provinces of Upper Canada and Lower Canada. So it's like if all Scots are Celt and all Celts were, you know, Irish, then we're all from Quebec originally. If you go back far enough, colony of Quebec. Divided in 1791. We were up in Upper Canada. The population of Ontario had risen to above 10,000. Nearly all of them settled along the waterway. Only four Masonic lodges were active in Upper Canada, two at Niagara and one each at Brockville and Cornwall. Even counting unaffiliated Masons, there were no more than 300 members of the craft at the outside, and probably considerably fewer. Hard to believe, isn't it? So that was not that very long ago. Now we have a parting of the ways to convey. We're starting on our fourth year of Masonic Companion, largely due to and primarily due to your support. I hope that that we continue this relationship strengthens. The audience certainly seems to be growing. Can't imagine what that's about, but I look forward to being with you again in a week's time. I want you to think about some of the things that we've talked about, particularly the Sacred Trust of Freemasonry. It really boils down to the construction of Freemasonry that you undertake, and what that means. The things that are important to you are what's going to be passed on. So, you know, collectively, do we have what we need? Are we passing on all of the vital bits and pieces? I think we now have the advantage of 2020 hindsight and this incredible amount of information available at our fingertips. My goodness, our smartphones are smarter than most university libraries were when I started studying. So we're hard pressed to say we can't figure these things out. It's really, the work of it isn't the data and information. The work of this is posing the question. Ask the question and it helps develop the answers. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to speak with you again. This is, we're getting into the final couple of minutes of the show. Could talk to you about mysteries. That gets back to you know, it's been what have we been together for over an hour. Don't want to do that too much longer. I think we'll wrap this and I'll pick this up next week when we get into the mysteries. Okay, yeah, because it gets into Egypt and Egyptian history, and that would be more than a little bit of a departure. Freemasonry is an attitude, and Freemasonry is a mood. The parts that I like about the lodges or the idea of strict observance is that it credits us with needing to set the tone and atmosphere, and it restores something else that we've lost in our eagerness to evolve. We've given up the calculation, the inconvenience of making a calculation based on observation of the moon. Far too complicated, you'd say. I think that's a detriment to our order. I truly do. It's robbed us of something that was and is, I think, still important, that it's sort of taken something away from us. If you're asking about what I would consider important to bring forward, the sacred trust, I would want to restore that because, quite frankly, I don't understand the merit of being lunar lodges. I don't understand that, and I want to. But I think it has something to do with a connection with the universe, that every time you look up at the moon and you make your calculation, you're connecting with something that is out of this world. Metaphysical. We've given that up. And we've given up this sense of what's important to the landmarks of the area. Because I want to this tone and atmosphere, we've given up the introduction or the expectation that lodges would function with music. Again, music. We're not talking about the dour kind of music that we're going to find in churches. This wasn't the point at all. And even then, what sets the tone today would be different than what set the tone in 18th century Upper Canada or 18th century or 17th century Britain. But when we experience strict observance, there is a respect for encouraging a moment of reflection and to stretch our minds to be contemplative, and that's done through music. It creates the atmosphere for Freemasonry to occur, just as the pomp and circumstance of the opening of Grand Lodge does. It creates an atmosphere. Me, I'm one of those Masons that think that we have not done enough, that the ritual around and the pomp and circumstance needs to be more evident so that it has the greater impact on everybody, and that we're all good about that, that we all feel all right because we all understand that that kind of circumstance and ceremony has an effect on everybody. Why not heighten the good parts? So in my list of what we've given up, the given ups in our evolution, we've given up the lunar calculation. We've given up music, and we've given up that heightened sense of ceremony. Me, I'm old school. I'm old school, and I think some of you are too. So I'm gonna share with you a little bit from some people that you probably have heard of in your travels. This is from John Coltrane Quartet. He's playing these sessions with McCoy Tyner and Jimmy Garrison and Elvin Jones. And I'll leave you with it. I'll wish you all the very best. I hope I get a chance to meet and greet real soon, and that you in your endeavors that you experience the satisfaction of committing a random act of Masonic kindness for somebody. Best if they don't even know. That's the sweetest gesture of all. But if you can't do that, each and every day, commit to doing something. Be a good Boy Scout. Isn't that what we were taught? Be prepared. and to do something, do a favor, do something for somebody every day. Well, enjoy your week, and I'll look forward to being with you soon.
Thank you.